Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to be talking about some problems that our wildlife have, especially during migration. Our guest today will talk about a way to help wildlife by using specially designed corridors. So with us by phone today, Jody Hilty, President and Chief Scientist of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative in Canmore, Alberta. She's also a co-author of the book Corridor Ecology, Linking Landscapes for Biodiversity, Conservation, and Climate Adaptation. Have you seen a wildlife corridor, experience with them at all? What would you like to know about how they're designed and produced? I hope you'll join in as we visit with Jody Hilty. Your number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jody Hilty, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So you're president and chief scientist of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. Tell us about that initiative.
It would be my pleasure. So the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative was formed in 1993 to protect one of the last most intact mountain ecosystems from Yellowstone in Wyoming all the way up to the Arctic Circle in the Yukon. It's about a 2,000-mile-long corridor and is one of the few places on the planet where it still has an intact assemblage of large carnivores and all of the hoofed animals that were here pre-European settlement.
I think of about 2,000 miles, and I think about all of the roads and buildings and everything in the way. Talk about the challenges you face.
Yeah, well, our mission is to connect and protect this region so that both people and nature can thrive. And in the southern part of the region, this is a place where Outside Magazine and many other places are really promoting that this is a great place to live. It is a great place to live, like in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and other places. And so we have a lot of growth. It turns out that growth, as people move there, they're buying a lot of land, quite land-extensive development. And what that means, and they're also buying land and wanting to live right along public land. And that means that it's harder for animals to move off of public lands and protected areas to get between them. And it means that the corridors between those protected areas are increasingly being developed, and it makes it hard for animals to have the connectivity that they need. So, for example, something like a wolverine, there might only be 3 or 4 wolverines in the entire Grand Teton National Park. So a viable population of wolverines is something that would be not even just in the U.S. Rockies, but all the way up into Canada. And our challenge is ensuring that there is the ability for a population that's connected throughout that entire region to continue to thrive. And that means negotiating this increasingly human-occupied landscape. Other challenges in the landscape, you know, in addition to roads and development, are different kinds of natural resource extraction, whether it's logging or mining, and the way that that's practiced and where it happens can have pretty significant impacts on local populations.
So lots of challenges there, and not, you mentioned wolverine, but what would be the other species that you're most concerned with or zeroing in on?
Yeah, well, one of the animals that we focus on is grizzly bears, both because grizzly bears are incredibly sensitive to humans, and in fact, most grizzly bears in the United States die because of human-caused deaths. But also, some recent research at the University of Montana proved what we have long suspected, which is that grizzly bears are a pretty good umbrella species. What that means is, if we get conservation right for them, protected areas and the right connectivity zones or corridors, that actually it'll serve a lot of other wildlife. We're really concerned with all of the wildlife in that system and the ecological processes. That's things like fires and floods that really are necessary to sustain nature as it is in its natural state in the region. And that, it's hard to do it all at once, but there are many species that are at risk, whether it's cutthroat trout or bull trout or grizzly bears and wolverines, or even a lot of the different migrations of hooved animals like elk, like pronghorn. We're starting to lose those because people don't know that they're developing right in the middle of what has been, you know, often a thousands of years of migration corridor for these animals.
Oh, boy. Our guest today, Jody Hilty, President, Chief Scientist of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. Great to have her with us. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm kind of intrigued by the history of how this whole thing got going. It was back in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it was a time where science was really advancing, really due to technology. So there were all of a sudden there was the ability to put GPS collars on animals. And we were able to see that really that while protected areas are important, that these animals were moving at a scale that we simply hadn't understood before. There's one wolf named Pluie the Wolf that she traveled 100,000 square kilometers over two countries, two provinces, three states, and many, many different kinds of jurisdictions between public lands, private lands, reservations, and more. And she was a great example of, animals sort of pointing out that we really were doing conservation at the wrong scale, that we really need to be thinking at a large landscape scale if we want to conserve these amazing creatures that are really, in many cases, only found in the Waidawai region.
Did she survive, or was she run over by a car? Or?
She was actually legally harvested, meaning she was hunted with her pup just south of Kootenai National Park in British Columbia.
Oh.
So a very sad ending.
Yeah, a sad ending indeed for her. Well, where do we see... examples of wildlife corridors?
So there's a lot of different kinds of corridors. Perhaps one of the most famous ones in the Waidawai region that has a great name is Path of the Pronghorn. And it's a migration in and out of Grand Teton National Park. You know, there are about as many pronghorn as there are people in Wyoming. But the reason that this particular migration is so important, or the reasons, are that, one, it was sort of there's only one pathway in and out of the park at this point in time because of human development. And if someone put in the wrong kind of fence or housing development, it would mean the end of a species in a national park. And national parks are, they're part of their mandate is to maintain their biodiversity in their parks. The second reason is that this was documented with archaeological evidence to be over 6,000 years old. Back a little bit more than a decade ago, the scientists from the Wildlife Conservation Society and the National Park Service started to do some research on it. And ultimately, that research inspired the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and the Forest Service to sign a memorandum of understanding and commitment to protect this migration corridor called Path of the Pronghorn for the long term. What was really cool about that is about the same time as that was being developed, the then governor of Wyoming, Friedenthal, was so moved by this that he was hosting the Western Governors Association in Jackson, Wyoming that year, and he proposed a resolution to identify and protect corridors across all the Western states, which unanimously passed. And so it's really exciting that today the states across the West are engaging and thinking about those migration corridors. and how they're going to, you know, their priority migration corridors in each of those states and how they're going to protect them. So that's really neat. Even more recently, the Secretary of Interior at the federal level announced a secretarial order to identify and protect migration corridors. So it's really catching on. It's really exciting.
Well,
another kind of migration. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say another really cool component of migration corridors is trying to get animals across roads. So one of the places that there are crossing structures is on Path of the Pronghorn. And I remember at the time that they were putting them in, it was fall, the migration was starting to happen. And my colleague was down there sort of watching. And you know how construction goes, it was late. And so there were literally pronghorn piling up on one side of the highway. And he was about to pack it up. It was the end of the day, and the construction workers were going home. And he just sat there a little bit longer, and there wasn't even fencing yet along the bridge that they had put over this highway right next to Pinedale, Wyoming. And all of a sudden, he noticed that one individual started to kind of walk up and walk back and walk up and walk back. And all of a sudden it took off, and about 250 pronghorns followed this animal. And it was like, I remember very vividly getting the email saying, some days are better than others. And he sent me this amazing picture, and it was just so exciting that even though it hadn't even been finished, the pronghorn had already figured it out. And it turns out there are, in the YY region, there are at least 110 wildlife overpasses and wildlife underpasses under roads with associated fencing that help to keep wildlife connected across the country, able to move back and forth. So you can find them in lots of places in the Y2Y region.
Y2Y region, and you've got a great website too. And we'll talk some more about that, Jody. And Wendell and Marinette, I hope you can hang on. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then Wendell and Marinette, and maybe you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org with your own questions or experiences. Jody Hilty will be with us till 12:30. Let's take a quick look at the news and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about using corridors to help migrators move through our landscape, all those wild animals that need to move from one place to another. Jody Hilty is our guest. She's president, chief scientist of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative in Alberta. She's the co-author of the book Corridor Ecology, Linking Landscapes to Biodiversity Conservation and Climate Adaptation. The second edition of the book was released in April, so it's great to have her with us. Certainly, if you have questions about corridors, wildlife corridors, I hope you'll join in, maybe an experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jody, we have Wendell from Marinette who's been waiting a bit. So let's go to Wendell. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Well, what I'd like to ask your speaker is, what's the status of what's called the Wildlands Project? Years ago, David Foreman and others were a group of people who began a project to develop those corridors all the way from the southern border of the United States up into Canada and near Alaska. And I haven't heard much recently about that, but I'm sure your speaker knows a little bit about David Foreman, who has a very interesting career himself, also as one of the characters in Edward Abbey's famous Monkey Wrench game. So anything she could provide would be interesting.
All right, Wendell, thank you for calling. Jody, familiar?
It is familiar. Yeah, in fact, the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative was sort of birthed, if you will, from the Wildlands Network. The Wildlands Project has very much continued. There's a nonprofit today that's continuing that work, both on the science side as well as active work with lots of different partner groups on the ground. They're particularly active in places like the southwest of the United States and the southern Rockies, as well as along the east coast and sort of the Appalachian chain, among other places that they're working. They're a great group that, you know, has long been thinking about the need to do conservation at the right scale across North America. And there's groups around the world that are doing this work. I ran into somebody at a conference not too long ago that said, "Oh, you're from Waitawai. We're Baja to Bering. We're trying to do the same thing that you're doing in the marine environment." So many, many new efforts spawning every day, which is terrific to see.
Yeah, it is indeed. Wendell, thank you so much. Jeremy in Oconomowoc, it's your turn now. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you folks?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Great. Live in Back Montana, which is a great corridor up in the Kootenai National Forest. And I just hearing your guest speak of that just reminded me of how wild it is. And I brought my kids out there this summer, and just they were flabbergasted at.
Oh, you're breaking up.
And just sorry. Bye bye.
Oh, so. He was Jeremy was a forest fire firefighter in Montana and lived near that corridor that he was talking about. And you're familiar with it, I'm sure, Jody.
You know, I missed which corridor he was talking about, but I assume that he's talking about northwestern Montana and the Whitefish area, which, you know, it's interesting. That whole area, particularly in the Transboundary Flathead, it's between Canada and the U.S. is one of the areas it is the area with the highest carnivore diversity in the entire Waitawai region. And it is wild. It's just amazing. And it's a place, you know, it's got Glacier National Park and Waterton National Park, and so many people from the United States and really around the world go to visit that place because it is so outstanding.
John in West Allis emailed to ask how you get the animals to use the corridors. And, you know, you gave a kind of an example of one little example with the pronghorns. But talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, well, it's less about getting them to use it than figuring out where they already move and working to conserve it and make sure that movement can endure over the long term. With the specific sort of pinch points of underpasses and overpasses concerning roads, probably the best work that's been done trying to understand how and how animals learn to use them and whether they use them is in Banff National Park in Alberta, the very first national park in Canada. They've put over 40 wildlife crossing structures there and have the sort of longest term research. You know, it was interesting because they originally were just going to do a few years of research and be done with it. And at that point, it wasn't clear that it was benefiting the range of species that were originally intended to benefit from the underpasses and the overpasses. And it's only now, you know, more than almost 20 years later from the first structures, that with all of that data that we're able to actually tease out some of the differences. For example, if that park had decided, oh, we just don't want to spend any more extra money on overpasses, it would have changed the equation for animals like grizzly bears. And what I mean by that is that male grizzly bears will occasionally use underpasses, but females with cubs apparently won't. So if you want demographic connectivity, which is important from a genetic perspective and genetic health of a population, you need to have overpasses so that those females will use overpasses too. And it's been amazing to see the time lag. It took a while for animals to figure out where those crossing structures are. In the last month, I was driving through Kootenai National Park, which has a number of underpasses and some fencing associated with it. And as I was driving, I was fortunate enough to see this black bear walk very purposely right out of the woods directly to this underpass. It was clear that this animal maybe, you know, already knew that it was there. Maybe it had learned from its mom. But it was obvious that it knew what it was doing. It wasn't worried about using the underpass and just went right under as I was driving over. And so they do learn, and you know, some of them only use them once in their life. Some of them use them for migrations. Others use them to have breakfast on one side and lunch on the other. It's variable by species and individual.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm wondering, we a lot of talk about climate change now. How will climate change affect your corridor systems?
Yeah, we've done some work on that, and the WWE is the larger conservation and science community. One of the questions that we asked almost a decade ago in northwestern Montana was, how do we plan corridors such as between the greater Yellowstone ecosystem up to the Crown of the Continent ecosystem, which is where Glacier and Waterton are, and other core habitat areas? How do we plan them so that they'll be robust to climate change, meaning that they'll be useful for plants and animals, not just today, but in the future? And so we ran a number of different models, brought in different experts. And, you know, what was great to see is that actually because animals like grizzly bears and others often use river corridors as their movement pathways, that those are likely to be more robust over the long term, you know, even if climate changes. You know, it helps us to be reassured that we are trying to work on conservation of corridors that will work today and in the long term.
Let's take another call. Dennis in Two Rivers, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Hi, you're welcome. I wonder what your comments are about the planned border wall and wildlife migration. I'll listen offline.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about the planned wall along the U.S.-Mexican border.
Yep.
You know, some of that wall has already been built, and so there have already been impacts. So, for example, the Sonoran pronghorn have already lost the extent of their migration corridor. A lesser well-known story is that there used to be a transboundary population of bison or buffalo between Mexico and the United States. And when part of that wall was built, it actually cut off that migration. The Mexicans were determined to maintain a bison population. And so they actually restored a population south of that wall. But it does have a lot of impacts. You know, right now there used to be you know, a continuous population of jaguars through Mexico and into the southern United States. Now there are periodic individuals that show up in the Southwest. You know, if there's, you know, a border wall that's continuous, even in the rugged areas like the Sky Island region, it would definitely have impacts for wildlife connectivity now and also in the future if things are trying to sort themselves out. Given this change in climate. So it is something that we need to really be cognizant of going forward.
Dennis, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your own question or comment. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm wondering about how they are built in terms of financial things. Are they the result of public or private initiatives, both initiatives?
I think you're talking, are you talking about wildlife crossing structures over roads?
I was just talking about there's money connected with building those kinds of things.
Yeah, for sure. So if it's those kinds of infrastructural projects, generally speaking, most of that money is public money because it's part of public health and safety, right? If we can decrease wildlife roadkill on roads, it actually the economics of it, according to some recent research, show that it actually is economically beneficial, meaning it saves us money not to have those wildlife collisions. And so that's been one of the reasons that departments of transportation have invested in them. Occasionally, there are some private dollars that goes into them. With regards to getting corridors or getting the security of passage for wildlife across private lands, this is where land trusts really come in. And sometimes that's public dollars. A lot of times that's also significant private dollars. So, for example, the Nature Conservancy in the United States did one of the biggest land deals that the Nature Conservancy has ever done in northwestern Montana. And one of the things that that did was it helped in the context of the Y2Y vision to maintain connectivity in a really significant area. And that was really buying out a logging company that was looking to sell off a significant chunk of their lands. So that's another source of funding for those. If there's activities around, for example, coexistence on public lands, so that can be a reason why animals can't move from place to place because they get to, let's say, a really popular recreation area and the bears are getting into trouble with campgrounds and so forth, often bear-proofing those campgrounds and the awareness programs of how people need to move and camp in areas with large carnivores, yeah, that often comes from public dollars. But again, also nonprofit organizations often contribute to those. I know the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, for example, helps to support a lot of that kind of work.
Someone else wondered who takes care of these structures, for example, after they are built. Is there maintenance? Yeah, is there maintenance involved? And there must be some.
Sure, there is. Just like any underpass or overpass, often with underpasses, these are river corridors, because like I said, wildlife move along river corridors, and rather than just allowing for water through, they make them a little bit wider, so there's also an upland component that allows wildlife to move more easily next to the water, and those would be maintained just like any other culvert in road systems. Overpasses are, bridges. They're often what they call a double barrel overpass, which fortunately don't require as much maintenance as sort of the flat bridges that we often see, but eventually they will, and they'll have to be maintained just the same way other bridges are maintained. So that would be the Department of Transportation engaging in those projects.
Interesting. The latest edition of your book, which is, I'll mention it again, Corridor Ecology, Linking Landscapes for Biodiversity Conservation and Climate Adaptation, came out earlier this year. What's changed since the first edition was released some years ago?
So much.
Yes.
It's been so exciting. One of the really cool things that happened since we wrote that book was that they started talking about connectivity in the ocean. And so we actually have a contributed chapter by Mark Carr and one of his colleagues that is trying to understand why connectivity is so important, such as nearshore among coral reefs and even in the deep sea. And there's not just sort of extensive connectivity in the ocean, but there's also vertical connectivity. It's mind-boggling. Another thing that's happened that I really love is the use of technology. So there are all sorts of new ways to help us understand and predict where animals might be most likely to move. One of them is called CircuitScape. And what this clever person did was they took electrical circuit theory, you know, how electricity moves, and they applied it to animal movement. And it's really been revolutionary to help us understand where animals are moving, because some of these animals are so secretive and at such low densities that it would be really expensive and almost impossible to get enough data from, say, GPS collaring these individual animals and figuring out where they're going, and doing that in a sort of a time-bound way that we could actually get the data we need to drive forward appropriate management. So these new modeling techniques are super exciting. And I think the other thing that was really new is that when we published the first book, there was hardly anything written about connectivity and climate change. Yeah. And at the time of writing, there were over 250, I can't remember the exact number, new papers that were just researching the relationship between connectivity and climate change. And these are significant moves forward to help us be more effective in using what we know is a really critical tool, wildlife corridors, to advance biodiversity conservation.
And another area, I'm not sure you mentioned it or not, in terms of corridors, was air corridors.
Yeah, there has been discussion on air corridors as well. We haven't seen any sort of concrete, tangible, designated corridors through airspace yet, but there are certainly the beginnings of discussions around air corridors that, again, really fascinating. How do you do it? Who owns that airspace? How do you regulate it? And how do you ensure that things that migrate, like, golden eagles that migrate up and down the Yellowstone to Yukon region, have that airspace that they need that's secure for the long term?
It's just mind-boggling. I never thought about an air corridor, but it's amazing. Here you are. You're the chief scientist at the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. How do you assess your progress, and where are you in terms of progress?
Well, it's a very exciting time for Y2Y. When we first formed, people thought that our idea was audacious. The West Wing show actually featured us under Wingnut Ideas. What's really exciting today is that we have made substantial progress. On the land side of things, we did need to secure some new lands, and protected areas have increased by more than 50% across the Yellowstone to Yukon region, according to our recent analyses. And, we have communities who once said, there's no way I will ever live near or with grizzly bears, who are now, thriving tourist communities, who have all of a sudden decided to bear-proof their communities and are seeing actual benefits with both tourism and also, are realizing that it's not such a big deal to live necessarily with grizzly bears. We are seeing, this whole thing of road ecology and making sure that wildlife can get safely across roads take off. I mean, to have more than 100 wildlife crossing structures in one region is great. Our ultimate goal is to ensure that this is a normalized practice across all the busy roads in the Y2Y region, and I think we're getting there.
Well,
it's another good sign.
I was going to say, I wanted to be sure to mention here, as we run out of time a little bit, that your website, I'm really enjoying it. It's y2y.net, and it's the letter Y, the number two, and the letter Y. So just three things there, y2y.net. And it's some fascinating stories and fascinating information, Jody, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. It's been great visiting with you, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you so much. Jody Hilty, our guest today, she's the co-author of the book Corridor Ecology, the second edition. It's Linking Landscapes for Biodiversity Conservation and Climate Adaptation. Great to have her with us. Tomorrow, we turn our attention to vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward. He'll be back. Looking forward to that at 11. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.